G'day, ghosts and ghouls and lovers of spine-tingling tales. It's your mate, the Tale Teller, back to tickle your terror bone. Don't worry, we'll consult an anatomy chart later to see if that's a real thing. Anyway, tonight we're diving into the world of the halls of fantasy, where the drama is high, the suspense is thick. Well, let's just say they've got worse luck than a kangaroo trying to cross a six-lane highway. First up, we've got the judge's house, where a poor scholar named Malcolm Malcolmson, that's a tongue twister, moves into what he thinks is a charming fixer-upper. Turns out, it's less charming and more murderous ghost Airbnb. Spoiler alert, though. The previous tenant was Judge Doom himself, and let me tell you, he's not great with the refund policy. Then, we're heading straight into the Mark of Shame, where Edward Blake discovers the hard way that karma is not only real, but also comes with its own glooming, ominous scar. If you thought your embarrassing tattoo was bad, wait until you hear how Edward gets caught up in spectral drama. Let's just say he's got more ghosts following him than normally would be the case. So grab your snacks, dim the lights, and maybe lock the door. Because tonight you're in for a treat of old-time radio dramas. Straight from the halls of fantasy vault. This is Stories, Fables, Ghostly Tales, and I am the Tale Teller, your guide through the weird, the wild, and wonderfully spooky. Let's get on into it, shall we? Enjoy.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Granite Furniture Company with stores in Sugar House, Murray, and Provo presents... The Hall of Fantasy. Welcome to the Hall of Fantasy. Welcome to the series of radio dramas dedicated to the supernatural, the unusual, and the unknown. Come with me, my friends. We shall descend to the world of the unknown and forbidden, down to the depths where the veil of time is lifted and the supernatural reigns as king. Come with me and listen to the tale of The Mark of Shame. The Granite Furniture Company brings you the Hall of Fantasy. Listen now to original tales of the imagination and some of the classics of the supernatural as we take you down the corridors of the Hall of Fantasy to the mysterious realms of the unknown. These are stories of eerie and fantastic thrills brought to you by your friends at the Granite Furniture Stores. And now for tonight's story, an adaptation by Robert Olson entitled The Mark of Shame.
Through the veins of Cousin Andre did more than run the natural errands of existence. That blood fed his hates, his prides, his will for ego, to the end of time and beyond. Yes, and that same blood flushed a vivid red mark of shame in Andre's fair young face. It was phenomenal, nothing like I'd ever seen before, nothing certainly like the welts in a child's tender back. This mark never faded from his handsome, womanish cheek. As usual, it had started over a woman. This happened at a masquerade ball given in the Palais Royal. A logical setting for quarrels over women, or privileges, or just quarrels. It was a gay affair. The women who followed in the footsteps of Philip of Orléans were likely grounds for controversy. One could hardly refer to their love as steadfast, but their favors swung from one brightly caped courtier to the other, from a fallen sword to a victorious one, with the swiftness of death itself. But such were our times. And in this colorful gathering, it was not difficult to recognize the predominant shade as a blood red. No need to mention the woman's name. Makes no difference anyway. She was not the issue. The issue was that André de Brissac, darling of the court, had been shamed, and I had dealt the smarting blow. I remember that moment with amazing detail. It was as if everything in that ballroom had suddenly been caught in startling paralysis of time, poised between one tick of the clock and another, one heartbeat and the next. Even the note of the music hung suspended, undecided whether to fly out the rich windows or fall and splinter like a Christmas ornament. I remember the dancers caught midway in a step, their faces turned toward me, the frozen gasp of the woman in question, sound that seemed barely to clear her lips, and paused in the awful highlight of that instant. And in Andre's eyes, poised the sharp, tempered steel of hatred and humiliation. Then, as if some unseen conductor waved the baton, the room was once more animated. The clock completed its tick, the heart its beat, and the note its soaring flight. The hatred of Andre de Brissac flushed from the eye to the heart to the brain, thence to the voice that made it live in my memory forever. But the most amazing phenomena occurred a moment later, while he still stared at me. For to Andre, there came a crimson blush of shame, clearly outlined by the very form of my hand, in the exact spot where it had landed a flashing, stinging slap. So it was that on that dim August dawn, Andre and I crossed to one of the bridges that led to the ground beyond the church of Saint-Germain-des-Prés, to fight a duel over a beautiful viper of the court of Philip of Orléans. Andre stood there opposite me with his two young friends at his side. They were all scoundrels, including my cousin, sorry to say. They seemed eager for this sport. We must have made a strange sight in that golden sunrise hour. We had just come from the Regent Saloon, still in the costumes we'd worn the night before. I was adorned, if adorn is the proper word for it, as a Mississippi Indian, while Andre wore a unique hunting habit, copied from a portrait that hung in the library of Puy Verdun, the family chateau. The orange and purple of his adornment looked pale in this early light. The mark on his face was all the more vivid.
I am ready, cousin.
Andre, when this is over, no matter what happens, will you promise me one thing?
Please. When this is over, one of us will be standing, the other dead. That's the only promise I care to make now.
That's true, Andre. But you force me into a situation for which I have no appetite. I'm a soldier, Andre. It is my business to cut down my enemy. Now, I'm the better swordsman. That's why we must talk now or not at all.
Then if you don't mind, cousin, we'll make it not at all. As for your being a better swordsman, you'll do me the honor of proving your skill.
Your curly locks have sabotaged your good judgment, sir. The captivating ladies of the court shall miss their nimble-tongued darling.
Oh, but they shan't miss his boorish cousin. Enough of this. On guard!
On guard, cousin! You stand well, my merry fellow of fortune. But I could teach you much.
Conserve your breath, cousin.
Ah, your beautiful face, Andre. Your parry was poor. My sword is tipped with crimson. Your lovely powder bearer would swoon to see that. It goes ill for you, I fear.
You glowed over a scratch.
Andre was really quite skillful. But not skillful enough. My contention that the court's fencing master could never compare to the art of learned die of brutality of battle proved correct. I mortally wounded Andre, and instantly I was mortally sorry. Life had been sweet for him as he lay there on the ground, the golden morning sun giving his beautiful features a pitiful glow. I thought I saw a look of despair come into his eyes. He realized that his lifeblood was ebbing away like a tide that would never return. He beckoned to me, and I walked over to him and knelt at his side. Andre, forgive me.
Listen to me, Hector de Brissac. This is not the end of us. I am not done with the earth. Just because my jaw will soon stiffen and my eyes glaze over, they will bury me in the old vault at Puy Verdun. But that is not the end either. You will be the master of the chateau. They may even laugh to think that Andre has been killed in a duel. They will sing masses to my soul, and I will be done with them all. You have accomplished that, Hector, but you and I have not finished our business. I will be with you when you least know me. Andre de Brissac, with an ugly scar on a face that women have praised, loved. Come back when your life is its merriest. At your happiest moment, I will come between you and all that you hold dear. And when this hand is a ghostly thing, dear cousin, I shall drop a poison into your cup of happiness. I shall stand between you and the sun for the rest of your life. Doubt not my will, Hector de Brissac. I can do as I please. And it pleases me to haunt you when I am dead.
I did not doubt the ironwood of Andre. As he lay his head back on the dewy earth, never to lift it again, the chill breath of early morning touched me with inexpressible loneliness. I looked at him as he lay in his fresh, one world of sleep. How fragile he seemed, built only for lace cuffs and bright buckles. I could see why he had been such a favorite. I could almost, even now, catch the fiery twinkle of those clear eyes. And no one who knew the short manhood of my cousin could deny the great force of his tempestuous nature. No, I looked down upon that young face which I had marked so foully, was sorry for what I had done, truly sorry. As for the curse, I took no heed of the blasphemous threats. I was a soldier. I had seen many men die for my own sword. Andre had done me a cruel wrong. I couldn't have forgiven it. Men had died cursing me before, men who had loved life as rapturously as Andre. One more curse was... well, one more curse. I put it out of my mind. A very foolish thing to do. Andre's death had made me rich, but I found no pleasure in the wealth. The chateau, which had rung so with the raucous laughter of Andre's friend, became quiet and lonely. None of the servants showed me the slightest sign of friendliness. Even in the village, the children would shrink from me as I rode through. That's why I was so happy when the servant announced that Monsieur le Docteur was waiting to see me. Dr. Corday, I'm delighted, monsieur.
Oh, thank you, my lord. I have some medical reports on the patients in the village. I thought you might want to look them over.
I know nothing about such things, Corday. If there's no ravaging epidemic, I should be happy to dispense with it altogether.
Oh, there's nothing to fear. The usual aches and our share of deaths and our share of babies.
Good, doctor. Will you join me?
Well, I...
Do, monsieur.
Thank you.
Dr. Corday, what do the people in the village say about me?
Say? Why, the people love you, my lord.
You can dispense with them, my lord, Corday. I'm a soldier, not a court dandy. What do the people really say?
Shall I tell you?
Of course you should tell me. Why do you suppose I asked you? Oh, monsieur, forgive me. This is a bitter life. I have no taste for it. I'd rather be a soldier. I really would.
Well, in that case, you'd be quite interested in hearing what the people of the village say.
What is that?
That you have sold your soul to the evil one for your cousin's heritage.
That's really funny, doctor. Really very funny. I never wanted this life, never once. I wouldn't hesitate a moment to trade it for a place in His Majesty's troops.
What you need is a wife, my lord.
A wife? I can't even win the sympathetic ear of a friend, let alone the heart of a lady.
It's a very gay season in Paris right now, my lord. You should find an angel there to take compassion on you.
Paris? A marvelous idea. At least I can be my own man there. Doctor, I'm grateful for your visit. Come in again when I return.
With a wife?
Who knows? In Paris, I ran into an old comrade, a sulky, sour old captain of dragoons. Many times he'd aired his displeasures to me. He told me a great many things about himself. But one thing he should have talked about, he never even mentioned. That was that he had a perfect sunbeam for a daughter. That her name was... Can you hear the music as I say it? Eveline. Eveline Bacalay. Eveline, I've been a fool.
Is it wise to tell me, monsieur?
Wise or not, I must. Eveline, I've been a soldier all my life. I know little about what pleases a lady. When I take your hand, I'm filled with the fear that you will not feel as I do, that there's someone else.
There is no one, monsieur.
Thank heaven. Eveline, I've wasted the best years of my youth worshipping a wicked woman who cheated me and finally made a fool of me.
She was the fool, monsieur.
Bless you for saying that, Eveline. Well, you must know what I'm trying to say. I'm told women do know. I love you, Eveline. I want you to go back to Puy-Verdun with me.
Oh, monsieur.
As my wife, will you?
You will have to speak to my father.
Forgive me, but I already have.
Oh, you are a soldier, monsieur.
But what is your answer, Eveline?
I will marry you.
Oh, Eveline, my adorable one. This is...
Yes, go on. Is anything the matter?
No. No, of course not. This is the happiest moment of my life.
You are listening to The Mark of Shame on tonight's journey down the corridors of the Hall of Fantasy. Brought to you by your friends at the Granite Furniture Company, with stores in Sugar House, Murray, and Provo. And now, back to tonight's story, The Mark of Shame. Weaver Dunn was not the sordid, lonely place I had left. The difference was my charming bride. Now, when I rode through the village, the children actually crowded about our carriage. I no longer feared the Debussac who sat beside the lady. Her charities had won her their love and transformed the gloomy lord into a gentle master. They even forgot the untimely death of my cousin. And I no longer hesitated, with that strange catch in my throat, to tell her about it. Eveline, I never knew I could be so happy.
Why, too, Hector. I'm happier than I ever dreamed.
Even the villagers feel it. They used to avoid me like a plague.
You only imagine that. Why should they avoid such a gentle master?
Maybe it's because you've made me so, Eveline. I feel like a traveler who's just been transplanted from the frozen Arctic wastes to the heart of some green and friendly valley. It's almost... Oh, I don't know, darling. Sometimes I doubt it.
Why, dearest?
It seems almost fantastic to be so happy. I could be aroused so rudely at any moment with a coarse shout of reality.
You aren't dreaming, husband. I won't allow it. For you know, if you were, I would be too, and I wouldn't like that.
See what I mean? Nothing like this ever happened to me before. It's like standing in the bright sun.
Hector?
Yes?
Who's the lord of the chateau nearest to this?
What?
Who is he, Hector?
Darling, don't you realize that this is the only chateau within 40 miles?
That's strange.
Why?
Because I saw him again yesterday.
Him? Whom do you see?
I don't know now.
Suppose you tell me about it.
Well, in my walks about the park and woods in the past month, I keep meeting a man who appears to be of a noble rank.
Of noble rank? Are you sure you don't mean a peasant?
No. His dress and his bearing was that of a nobleman. I couldn't have mistaken that. I imagined that he must occupy some chateau near Puy-Verdun.
That's not possible, Eveline. We're in the heart of a desolate region. No, that couldn't be possible. Well, come here a moment.
Yes, monsieur.
See the picture there on the wall?
This one, monsieur?
No, the one next to it. That's right. I want you to...
Yes, monsieur.
I want a curtain hung over that picture as soon as possible, understand?
Oui, monsieur.
Good. Now bring some tea to your lady's drawing room. In spite of myself, I was disturbed by Eveline's visitant. That night I asked her more about it. Eveline, this man you say you saw...
Say I saw. I did, in fact, I do see him.
How often?
Every day.
Every day where?
Sometimes in the park and sometimes in the wood. You know that little cascade and the old rock work that makes a sort of a cavern?
Yes, I know the place. I used to play there with... I used to play there as a boy.
Oh, I love it. I spend my mornings there reading.
And that's where you saw... See him?
Yes.
Has he ever had the courage to address you?
Never. I look up from my book and he'll be standing there very quietly, watching me. Then I'll continue with my reading, and when I look up again, he's gone.
He must be some peasant out to frighten you. I'll go into the village tomorrow and see what I can find out.
No, Hector, he's not a peasant. He has the manner of a nobleman.
I suppose he's quite old.
On the contrary, he's young and quite handsome.
For the next week, I spent my mornings with Eveline. We took many casual rambles into the woods and park, but we saw no one but a few peasants or occasionally a member of our own chateau. These works were beginning to disturb the routine of my life. And since I was a man of rather deeply ingrained habits, my wife noticed the unrest.
There's no need to take these walks with me, Hector. You know, you have other things to do. I'll spend my mornings on the grounds, and the stranger can't intrude on me there.
I'm beginning to think the stranger is your own fantasy, darling. You've probably met too many handsome cavaliers in your books. No doubt he's some Persian prince in modern costume.
Hector, that's what puzzled me. The stranger's costume isn't modern. Shall I tell you what it looks like?
By all means.
Well, he looks as if he's been in an old portrait that had stepped down from his frame.
Wouldn't have been a more startling blow if she butted me in the stomach with the end of a staff. I thought of the picture in the library with the orange and purple hunting costume Andre had worn that fateful night in the Palais Royal. But then something else happened to take my mind from the picture, Andre or anything else. For after a time, my wife, who had always been as lovely and glowing as the fresh petal of a rose, began to fail in her health. Her change seemed to have stolen up on her. Even I, who had seen her every day, hadn't noticed it until one day she put on a lovely gown she hadn't worn in several months. I was amazed how loosely it hung on her. Then I noticed her eyes. Eyes that had at one time sparkled as bright as the jewels she'd planted in her hair. They were now quite dim and sick. Darling, how long have you been ill?
I'm not ill, Hector.
That's insane. You are ill. Quite seriously so, I might add. Stupid of me not to notice it before. What's done this?
I feel faint.
And she fainted. I caught her in my arms and swept her to her bed. Then I sent a messenger for Dr. Corday. Tell him to come immediately. I don't want a single moment's delay, understand?
Yes, monsieur.
I stood there as helpless as a child and watched my lovely Eveline seem to waste away with this insidious thing. I cursed every moment of delay before Dr. Corday arrived. When he did come, I rushed him to her room before he even had a chance to remove his cape. Then I sat and poured myself a drink for the torturous wait. Even before he came out to speak to me, I, for no explainable reason, had lost faith in the powers of medicine to combat the thing that had struck down my Eveline.
Strange, very strange.
Doctor, is she...
Frankly, I don't know. I just don't know, my lord.
Monsieur le docteur, I was beginning to be afraid that she may be a little... Well, Dr. Corday, this isn't easy to say.
Well, then, let me say it for you. You're wondering if she's insane. Let me assure you that she is not.
Oh, thank heaven. She's been seeing some... Well...
Oh, you mean this strange visitant? Oh, yes, she spoke of it. It's possible that she may be suffering from some sort of illusion at that. But she's so rational on all the other accounts. I think that this person is quite real, at least to the eye. Usually, a monomaniac tells very incoherent stories of their illusions. Hers is no such thing. She speaks as calmly and rationally as you and I. Are you positive that there is no one who can encounter her in her walks about the garden?
I don't see how. The moat is 10 feet wide and continually flooded with water. Raoul keeps the lock secured day and night. No, I don't see how it's possible.
Well, perhaps someone related to your household in some way. A young man with a fair womanish face and a crimson scar that looks as if it might have been the mark of a violent blow.
Oh, no. The dress, Doctor. How is he dressed?
In a hunting costume. A purple and orange hunting costume.
Doctor, this... Oh, no. What can I do?
Right now, my lord, you'd better go in and see Lady de Brissac. She's asked for you.
Darling, how are you?
Oh, Hector.
Evelyn, why haven't you told me? The doctor says you've seen the stranger again.
I see him every day. What's killing me?
I rushed down to the library, took down the portrait and showed it to my wife. She looked at it and trembled like a leaf. She clung to me as if she were about to fall into some nameless chasm.
It's witchcraft. Costume is the very same.
Then she described his face to me, line for line, even to the cruel mark my hand had left. I knew that Henri de Brissac had come back to keep his promise. I took Eveline away. We traveled through the southern provinces and on into the heart of Switzerland. I wanted to outdistance the phantom. It was no good. He followed us everywhere we went. Never did I see him. Always Eveline. That type of vengeance had Andre's touch. He used my wife's innocent heart as his cruel weapon. His constant, unholy intrusion was destroying her. Nor could I shield her or drive Andre from her.
He's here even now, Hector. As you stand there and I here, he stands between us. He'll never let me rest nor let me forget.
Thus it was I fought like a madman against something I couldn't see, fought through this terrible void to get back to the side of my beloved wife. And then, a short time later... We were in a Tyrolean village. It was a brilliant moonlit night. I was about to speak a word of encouragement to Eveline when she spoke.
Hector, I'm going to tell you something so strange and terrible that you'll probably hate me forever.
Hate you? Why, my poor darling.
Oh, no, please, don't sympathize with me. I won't be able to tell you, and I must tell you, I must.
Darling, you're just tired. What you need is some
Hector,
rest.
Hector, I'm dying.
No. No, Eveline, you're not.
Yes, I know it. That's why I must say what I have to say.
I won't listen.
You must listen. At first, when I began to see the stranger in the park, I shrank from him. He seemed terrible to me. Day after day, he came. Then one day, I wasn't afraid anymore. I found that I was thinking about him, watching for him. Then for a while, I didn't see him.
Was that when I was with you?
Yes. Even then, when I was with you, I found that I was desolate without him.
Eveline, you don't know what you're saying.
Oh, believe me, Hector, I do. I wouldn't blame you if you killed me. But I began to count the hours to the time when I'd see him next. He took all the old joys from my heart and left me nothing but the unholy pleasure of his presence. Now, Hector, curse me, kill me, anything. Only know this. Whatever it was, witchcraft, the imperfections of my heart, I don't know. I only know I fought against it and couldn't win. Now I'm dying, and oh, forgive me if you can.
Forgive you? What is there to forgive, my darling? This is no work of yours. Oh, Emily, my wife, forget everything but that you're in my arms. Forget everything except that we love each other.
I'm dying, Hector. I'm dying.
No. Fight it, Eveline. Please try to fight it. I need you. I can't live without you.
Believe me, Hector. I want to die. I want to be with you.
Her eyes fluttered and she was gone. Something more than the cruel lash of her words hit me. Even though I was barely conscious, I felt it. I got up and ran to the mirror. Sure enough, there it was. That vivid outline of the hand, full across my cheek.
So runs the tale of The Mark of Shame.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Granite Furniture Company, with stores in Sugar House, Murray, and Provo, presents
The Hall of Fantasy. Welcome to the Hall of Fantasy. Welcome to the series of radio dramas dedicated to the supernatural, the unusual, and the unknown. Come with me, my friends. We shall ascend to the world of the unknown and forbidden, down to the depths where the veil of time is lifted and the supernatural reigns as king. Come with me and listen to the tale of The Judge's House.
The Granite Furniture Company brings you the Hall of Fantasy. Listen now to original tales of the imagination and some of the classics of the supernatural as we take you down the corridors of the Hall of Fantasy to the mysterious realms of the unknown. These are stories of eerie and fantastic thrills brought to you by your friends at the Granite Furniture Stores. And now for tonight's story, a radio adaptation by Bob Olson of Bram Stoker's story entitled The Judge's House. Justice. Peace. How can we be certain of either when hatred burns unchecked, even beyond the grave? I am Malcolm Lane. This is my story. I want to tell it to you while there is still time. I watched them carry the parcels into the judge's house. Mrs. Whittam, whom I had engaged as my housekeeper for the next 3 months, was directing the activity. She was an amusing little character. I had to promise that she wouldn't have to stay in the house after it began to get dark. The upholsterer's man was coming up the pathway with a cart and a new bed. Mrs. Whittam had insisted on this one new piece of furniture because, as she put it,
a bed that just hasn't been aired for 50 years is not fit for young bodies to lie on.
And she was right, of course. But my head was too full of plans for study to worry about such details as my living quarters. As for the tales about the harsh old judge whose house this had once been, I had only a mild enthusiasm. He must have been quite a character, though, to make an entire village fear him and his house, even 50 years after his death. Mrs. Whittam was positive there was something about the old place, though she nor anyone else quite knew what it was. The consensus of opinion, however, was that they would not take all the money in Drinwater's bank to spend an hour here alone. But Mrs. Whittam startled me with a very rational statement.
The place is full of rats, and rats is bogies, just the same as bogies is rats.
That explanation suited me very well, for as I said once before, my head was full of plans to study. Examinations were coming up soon, and I had paid 3 months' rent in this old house so that I would be assured of peace and quiet while I prepared for them. The only mysteries I'm interested in, Mrs. Whittem, are those of harmonical progression and elliptical functions. They're mystery enough for me.
Not that you won't find company here, Mr. Lane. I've already cleaned all of 50 years of dust from everything. Oh, but that wainscot in this room must be hundreds of years old. And you'll find creaky doors aplenty, and loose flats all over, ready to flap in the wind. And bureau drawers that stick and then fall down in the middle of the night.
And don't forget the rats.
No, Mr. Lane, don't forget the rats.
The workmen were all gone, and but for the busy little figure of the housekeeper, I was alone. It was for this that I'd taken the tiresome ride to Benchurch, a remote little town that had all the attractions of a desert. It was drawing close to evening as Mrs. Whittem was unpacking the last hamper, and I could see that she was beginning to cast worried glances about as the shadows began to creep into the corners of this huge dining room I'd chosen for my living quarters. Oh, you may go now, Mrs. Whittem. It's getting dark in here, and I'm sure you're anxious to get home. You've done well with this old room. I shall reward you with complete possession of this house for the last 2 months of my tenancy. 3 or 4 weeks will be all I'll need, and I'd hate to see that rent money go to waste.
Thank you kindly, sir, but I wouldn't stay here
I know, for all the money in Drinkwater's bank. I'm really grateful, for I do want to be alone. And if you were not so opposed to it, I might be tempted to accept your company.
Ah, you young gentleman. You fear nothing, and I'm certain you'll get all the solitude you need here. Good night, sir. You'll find your supper beneath the cloth.
Good night, Mrs. Whittem. Oh, yes, this was comfort. After I'd finished my supper, I cleared the great oak table and got my books out. Then when I'd put fresh wood in the fire and trimmed the lamp, I sat down to a spell of hard work. I hardly looked up from my books until nearly 11 o'clock, at which time I threw some more wood in the fire and indulged in one of my most deeply ingrained habits, that of tea drinking. I thoroughly enjoyed tea and drank it this night with a sense of real enjoyment. Soon the new wood I had thrown in the fire began to crackle, and the new flame threw quaint shadows about the great old room. And as I sat there sipping my tea, I reveled in the complete sense of isolation. Then, for the first time, I noticed the noise of the rats. Strange, I hadn't heard them before. Maybe they're just getting used to me. But they're bold enough now. How busy they were. What strange noises they made. Up and down the old wainscot they went, and over the ceiling and over the floor, racing and gnawing and scratching. There were so many of them that I'd have sworn that if they set their strength to it, they could have carried the house away. I had a smile when I recalled the words of Mrs. Whittem. Rats is bogies, and bogies is rats. The stimulation of the tea gave me a sense of security, and I grabbed the lamp to take a good look around the room. Strange why such a beautiful old place should have been so neglected for all this time. The carving on the oak panels of the wainscot was fine indeed, and that around the doors and windows was of rare merit. I saw some old pictures on the wall next to the fireplace, but they were coated so thick with dust that I couldn't distinguish any of their details, even though I did hold the lamp high above my head. Now and then I would get a quick start as the light fell upon the old walls and disclosed the glittering eyes of a rat as he would stick his face out of a hole or a crack. In an instant, it would disappear with a squeak and a scamper. Another object that struck me as odd was the rope of a great alarm bell that hung in the corner of the room on the right-hand side of the fireplace. After my inspection tour, I sat in the high-backed chair that was near the fireplace and sipped from another cup of tea. For a while, I thought the noise of the rats would drive me to distraction, but that eased off and I became accustomed to it, the same as a person gets used to the roar of water when he camps beside a stream. Soon I was so engrossed in a mathematical problem that I forgot everything else in the world. But since the solution to the problem came stubbornly, I looked up and was surprised to see that the fire had fallen to a dull red glow. There was a sudden quiet, the strange hush that comes in the hour before dawn. I became aware for the first time that the noise of the rats had ceased. When it had happened, I couldn't remember. Something instinctive told me that it had been in the last few moments, and that it had been sudden. I looked up, and what I saw What I saw was a most amazing thing. For there on the high back chair sat an enormous rat staring at me through deadly, malignant eyes. I tried to frighten it away, but it didn't stir. I made a motion as if to throw something at it. It only bared its teeth angrily, and its cruel eyes shone all the more bright. I'd grabbed the poker from the hearth and was going to kill the creature. But before I could reach it, that enormous rat jumped to the floor, and with a squeak that sounded like a consummate hit of the whole world, scampered up the rope of the alarm bell and disappeared in the darkness. Then, as if by a signal, the noise of the other rat started all over again. By this time, I gave up working my problem, bartered it for some much-needed sleep. It was Mrs. Whittem who woke me as she came in to make up the room.
You're much paler this morning, Mr. Lane.
I am.
You shouldn't stay up so late with your work. It isn't good for you. But tell me, how did you spend the night? I was certainly glad to see you.
Alive? Oh, yes, that was quite all right, Mrs. Whittem. The something didn't worry me too much. But the rats certainly held themselves a camp meeting. There was one that sat up in that chair by the fireplace and wouldn't go away until I chased him with a poker. It was the biggest old devil I've ever seen.
Old devil? Maybe it was the old devil.
I only meant
Never that... you mind, sir. Many a true word is spoken in jest.
Well, pardon me, Mrs. Whittem. I didn't mean to be rude. But the thought of the old devil himself sitting in that chair last night struck me as being rather funny.
And it's a good thing you can laugh. But all the same, if I were to spend the night here tonight, oh, heaven forbid, I'd make sure I was ready for it.
That night, the rats put on an earlier show, for their scamperings began almost as soon as I'd finished with my supper. The cursed creatures seemed to get on my nerves, and I sat there and puffed my pipe. While they squealed and scratched and gnawed, they seemed to grow bolder by the minute. By now they were coming to the chinks and cracks in the wall until their eyes shone like miniature lamps when the firelight struck them. They'd even make bold sallies under the floor, and I'd have to frighten them away by pounding on the table with my fist. That was how I passed the early part of that night. Despite it, I became more and more engrossed in my studies. And then, a strange sensation coursed through me. Well, there it was again. Instinctively, I grabbed the handiest object I could find, a book, and flung it at the baleful little beast. But the book was too hastily aimed, and the huge rat didn't stir. So once again, I went into the poker routine. And once again, it put up the rope of the alarm bell. I tried to follow its flight more closely this time, but before I could see where it went, it had been swallowed up in the shadows. And just as it happened last night, as soon as the big rat had gone, the others resumed their activity. I looked at my watch and found that it was very close to midnight. I built up the fire and brewed myself a pot of tea. I tried to get back to my work, but I suddenly became curious to know where the rat had disappeared to. For I was certain that tomorrow I would most likely get myself a rat trap. I gathered all my books about me and put them in a handy position for throwing. Then I took the rope of the alarm bell and placed the end of it upon the table underneath the lamp, where there would be plenty of light on it. As I picked up the rope, I was amazed how pliable and strong it was. Ideal, I thought, for hanging a man. Soon my preparations were complete. Well, this time, my friend, I intend to learn more about you. Once again, I was hard at my work, and the noise of the rats was forgotten. But just as suddenly as before, I was aroused by that same sense of startling silence. I was conscious of a slight movement in the rope at my elbow. Without stirring, I checked to see if my pile of books was in easy reach. It was. I cast my glance at the rope just in time to see the huge rat drop from it to the back of a high oak chair. I grabbed a book and hurled it. With amazing agility, the rat sprang aside and dodged it. I threw a second and a third, but each time it managed to dodge my battery. It was almost funny, almost. Finally, when I was down to the last book, I took careful aim, and as I did this, the rat squeaked and seemed afraid. I let the book fly. It struck the rat with a resounding thud. It gave out a shrill, terrified shriek, and running up the back of the chair made a desperate leap. And with the speed of a bolt of lightning, ran up the bell rope. The lamp rocked with a strain, but it didn't topple. Then I saw the rat leap to a molding and disappear through the hole in one of the big pictures that hung on the wall. I made a mental note of the exact spot. Third picture from the fireplace, huh? I'll remember that and have Mrs. Whittem scrub it clean the first thing tomorrow morning. I began to pick up the books I had thrown at the rat. As I did so, I took a good look at their titles. Conic sections. Mr. Rat doesn't seem to mind that. It would be this one on cycloidal oscillations, and this one on thermodynamics he dodged very neatly. Oh. Here's the book that got him. As I looked at the title of the book that had finally hit the huge rat, I could feel a pallor spread across my face. For the title of that book was The Holy Bible.
You are listening to The Judge's House by Bram Stoker in tonight's journey down the corridors of the Hall of Fantasy, brought to you by your friends at the Granite Furniture Company with stores in Sugar House, Murray, and Provo. And now back to the story by Bram Stoker entitled The Judge's House.
Mr. Lane, this is Dr. Thornhill.
Dr. Thornhill, are you ill, Mrs. Whittem?
Your pardon, Mr. Lane, but Mrs. Whittem wanted me to come up here and have a talk with you.
A talk? Well, in that case, let me prepare some tea for you.
Oh, please don't. That's one of the things I came to talk to you about. Mrs. Whittem thinks you drink more strong tea than is good for you. She tells me also that you put in quite long hours at your studies.
Mrs. Whittem, I engaged you as a housekeeper, not as a guardian.
Oh, please, Mr. Lane, I didn't
mean... As a matter of fact, Lane, she didn't mean to have me talk to you at all. That was my idea.
I see. Well, now that you're here, what do you want me to do?
Leave this house.
Well, even if I could see the reason for it, I doubt if I would. But as for the tea and late hours, I might be able to give them up. Would it make you feel any better, Mrs. Whittem, if I promised not to study after 1 o'clock tonight?
Yes, if you promise.
Then I promise.
I advise you, not as a total stranger to your problem, Mr. Lane... I was a student once myself, you know.
Of course. Shall we shake on it, Doctor?
Fine. Now, if you will, I wish you'd tell me what you've noticed in this house.
Well, it's just as I've told Mrs. Whittem. I'd be working late, and I'd suddenly... And when I looked to see which book it was that had struck the rat, the devil, as Mrs. Whittem calls it, I was amazed to find that it was the Holy Bible. There now. Please, Mrs. Whittem, you're not hurt.
Now, Mr. Lane, you say the rat always went up the rope of that alarm bell?
Always.
I suppose you know what that rope is?
No, why?
It's the very rope the hangman used to execute the victims of the judge's hatred.
Oh, no.
Now, Mrs. Whittem, there's no reason to get upset about this, really.
Doctor, you shouldn't put such horrible thoughts in poor Mr. Lane's mind. He has enough to unseat him already.
I did it for a definite purpose. Mr. Lane, I want you to fix your attention on that rope. Now, I know you're sound of mind and body, but hard work and long hours and this suggestion of the devil, especially in this lonely old house, can do things to the mind. Now, I don't mean this as any offense, but if you should find yourself having, well, hallucinations or some unexplainable fright, I want you to pull that rope. It'll give us some kind of a warning in the village. We might be able to be of some help.
Well, thank you, Doctor. I'll do that. I may get stuck with a problem.
Fine. Goodbye, Mr. Lane, and, well, I wouldn't be surprised if Benchurch hears the alarm bell from the judge's house tonight.
I didn't quite share the doctor's views, but just the same, I caught myself staring at the bell rope. The more I stared, the more restless I became, and every now and then my mind would conjure up the vision of some wretched victim dangling from the end of it. But that line of thinking would have me out of my mind in a hurry. Mrs. Whittem had made the place neat and homey. I wandered over to one of the big windows and flung it open. I was surprised to find that a sharp wind had come up, a very cold wind for April. It was more than a sharp wind, really, for it was carrying a storm. Little drops of rain began to pelt me in the face until soon it became a thing of fury. I bolted the shutters and built up the fire with some fresh wood. I was uncomfortable and was only vaguely conscious of the reason. Suddenly I knew. The rats were quiet tonight. It gave me a slight case of the jitters, and I instinctively took a hasty glance at the bell rope. The rope was quite still. I wanted a hot cup of tea, but remembering my promise to Mrs. Whittem, I desisted. Instead, I set up the great oak table and opened my books.
Soon I had started a problem, and the noise of the rats began. For the first time since I had taken up residence in the church's house, I was glad to hear those rats. I had worked for an hour or so and suddenly became conscious of the furious storm outside. I was thankful that I didn't have to be out yet. The faint movement of the bell rope compelled me to walk over to it and take it in my hand. I saw nothing. It had only been the wind, and the rope was rising and falling gently with each new gust of air, which caused the bell to sway back and forth a little. That rope had a deadly fascination to it. I wondered why the judge wanted such a grisly memento in his house. The thought of it sent a chill through me. Or was it a thought? Didn't I sense a tremor along that rope? I couldn't be sure, but at that moment I remembered the picture. I walked over to the table, picked up the lamp, and approached the spot where I'd seen the picture the night before. I counted out the pictures until I came to the third one from the fireplace. Even before I raised the lamp, I could see that Mrs. Whittem had washed it clean as I had told her to do. Then what I saw... What I saw gave me such a start that I nearly dropped the lamp. My knees almost gave way beneath me, and I was conscious of huge beads of perspiration that were forming on my forehead. Just looking at it made me tremble like an aspen leaf. The picture seemed fairly to leap out at me. For there, dressed in his scarlet and ermine robes with a judge, with his merciless, evil face, his sensual mouth, and a nose that was shaped like the beak of a bird of prey. His face had a cadaverous culling. It was a ghastly picture. But it was the eyes that really made me go cold. For those eyes were... And heaven help me if I'm going mad. Those eyes were the exact duplicate of the evil eyes of the great rat. The picture had been painted in this very room. I began to compare the two, and as my eyes swept the room, they were suddenly riveted to the judge's chair. For there, with the rope hanging behind it, sat the huge rat of the judge's eyes, and the hatefulness was now intensified with a fiendish leer. Never did the wind howl so. This had to stop. I wanted some tea, but I didn't take any. The doctor had been quite right, and it must have been getting drawn pretty taut. Strange, too, because I never was in better health. Well, no tea. We'll substitute some brandy. Let's see now. I had a stiff glass of the brandy and went back to work. The rats were at it again, and I was glad to hear them, for they had become a sort of symbol of normalcy. The storm raised such a fury that I was unaware of anything else. But once, during a sharp, silent lull, I heard another sound, a faint, squeaking noise. I listened for it again and soon detected it. It was coming from the corner of the room where the bell rope hung. At first, I thought it was just the motion of the rope in the storm, but I looked up and saw something in the dim light that made me all the more positive that I was going mad. For there was the great rat, clinging to the rope and gnawing at it. I could see the lighter coloring where the bare strands were exposed. Just then, the rat finished its job, and the rope fell to the floor with a thud. For a moment, the huge rat just hung there like a tassel. It was then that I realized what had happened. My only contact with the village was now gone. I don't know why, but I rushed to the lamp on the table, snatched off the shade, and ran over to the picture of the judge. A chill of horror went through me. But I think I must have expected what I saw. It seemed more like a confirmation than a shock. For there in the center of the picture was a great patch of brown canvas. As clean and as fresh as the day it had been drawn over the frame. And where the portrait of the judge himself had been, there was nothing. I heard a sound behind me. When I turned around, I really got the palsy. I suddenly became incapable of movement. I could hardly think. I had been prepared to see most anything, but what was there? For there in the judge's high-backed chair, with his black cap in his hand, his ermine robes fixed about him with a smile of triumph, twisting his cruel mouth, was the judge himself. As the clock struck the hour, it seemed to beat the blood right out of my heart. At the 12th stroke, the judge placed the black cap on his head and walked deliberately over to the place where the piece of bell rope lay in a heap on the floor. He picked it up and drew it through his hands as one would a valuable fur pelt. Then he began to knot one end, fashioning it into a noose. He tightened it and tested it with his foot. All this time, he never took his horribly cruel eyes from my face. I began to feel trapped. For some reason, I could barely move. I could only watch as he started to move along the table toward me. And then, with a quick movement, he
He threw the noose at me, as if to ensnare me in it. It missed. He raised it again, never once taking those hateful eyes from my face. Once more the noose came, flying toward me. Once more, with some last ounce of strength, I dodged it. The room seemed flooded with light. The lamp had suddenly flared up high. I looked about the room and was astonished to see the shiny little eyes of the rats as they peered out the cracks and chinks in the wall. I looked up at the bell rope, my lost and last hope of warning the village. It was covered with the little fellows. Funny thing, but those rats were the only thing that gave me even the slightest sense of comfort. But as the rats clambered along the bell rope, the bell itself began to sway, and I heard a tiny sound, yes, very tiny, as the clapper touched the bell itself. It was only a whisper of a sound, but it would grow louder in time. Or would it? At this sound, the judge looked up, and a scowl of terrible anger came to his face. His eyes were like red-hot coals, and he stamped his foot so that the house seemed to shake. The rats kept running up and down the rope as if they were conscious that it was a race against time. Now the judge was approaching me with a noose in his hand. As he came closer, there seemed to be something paralyzing in his presence, and I stood as rigid as a corpse. Suddenly, I felt the judge's icy fingers against the skin of my throat. He was adjusting the rope about my neck. Then he picked me up and stood me on the high oak chair and put his hand on the swaying end of the bell rope. As he raised his hand, I was conscious of my little rat friends fleeing through the hole in the ceiling. They were my last hope. I stood there on the chair and couldn't move a muscle. Now that my last hope seemed gone, I wanted the judge to hurry and get it over with. Soon he'd tied the end of the rope just about my neck, the dangling end of the bell rope. Then he jumped down to the floor and looked at me with those eyes that hated me so. The smile of diabolical triumph seemed to wreathe him in horror. I began to wonder about things. I wondered how long it would take, whether the doctor in the village could possibly reach me in time. For I knew that I would soon be sounding the alarm bell. I even wondered what kind of a shadow I'd cast on the wall as I dangled from the end of the rope in this grotesque candlelight. But I didn't wonder for long, because suddenly the judge grabbed the chair on which I was standing with a sudden movement, jerked it out from under me.
So runs the tale of The Judge's House.
And there we have it, folks. Another chilling ride through the spooky streets of the halls of fantasy. We learned tonight that staying in a haunted house for peace and quiet is as smart as wrestling a crocodile in a kiddie pool, and that karma always gets the last laugh, or rather, the last scar. Poor Edward, eh? Should have read the fine print on that life lesson. If you love tonight's stories, and let's be real, how could you not? Be sure to follow. And if you've got a story request, a spooky tale of your own, and just want to say, hey, tale teller, love what you do, drop me a line at storiesfablesghostlytales@gmail.com, or you can leave an iTunes review. Either way, I'd love to hear from you. And don't forget, folks, if the lights flicker tonight, if the wind howls just a little too loud, or if you hear a gavel slamming when no one's around, it's probably just your imagination. Probably. Legends, I'm going to thank my amazing superstars that support me on Patreon. These peeps not only keep the show running, they make sure that I never have to consider running advertisements, ever, but these legends allow me to branch out and do very different things. Like today, I remastered two old-time radio episodes just for you that sound like they've been put through a chainsaw. Normally, there's noise riddling every aspect of this kind of episode, and what I do is go through and clean it all up. Anyway, enough about what I do. I want to thank, first and foremost, my Ode Night Tea Titan, Matto Star, the deity of deities,
the king of tea.
Matto Star, because of you, I'm able to really push the envelope using a brand new AI sound generator. It's getting to a point where I can really alter my voice and tweak it.
Hey Matto, this is me. using the voice Lily, and I'm recording it just to say thank you. You're a legend, mate.
Super spooky, right? But I'm getting better and better thanks to your support. Your support is undying, never-ending, and forms the backbone of this podcast's ability to progress. With your support, I not only punch up, but I gain wings and I fly to the sky. Today's episode was a showcase of that. I might be able to include in here the original sound effects so you can see how much your support helps, because I get access to tools that deploy artificial intelligence to strip back all the noise. And without being too technical, it's because of your support and legendary Patreons like yourself that I can really clean this up. I'll pop it in here as an example. So here's what the original one sounded like.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Granite Furniture Company with stores in Sugar House, Murray, and Provo presents... Ladies and gentlemen, the Granite Furniture Company with stores in Sugar House, Murray, and Provo presents...
Thermato Star, you superstar, my pal, the King of T-Men. Thank you for your friendship, thank you for your support, and thank you for being an absolute legend. Have a wonderful, wonderful week, mate. And where am I as well now without my white tea warlords? I'm lucky enough to have three legends. My first white tea warlord is Lezasaurus Rex. Dare I say the myth, the man, the legend, but really what Leza is an Adonis god. One flex of that muscle and heartbeats go up. Need I say more? Leza, you are fantastic. And thank you for being my pal. And I read all the comments in Patreon. I just haven't had a chance to respond. So I'll be doing that very shortly. Because although I get a chance to read them, I didn't get a chance to like them, which was very silly of me. Such is the cost for work. Anyway, Lezasaurus Rex, a huge hug and a huge high five, my muscle-bound friend. I hope you have a fantastic time at the gym, which I'm guessing is when you're listening to me right now, probably on rep 1 billion. But jokes aside, thank you very much for your support and being my friend. Have a kick-butt week ahead of you. Cheers, mate. And to Joseph Schroeder, my next white tea warlord. Thank you so much for the belated birthdays and the commentary about the news story that came through dedicated to Maya. I had a fantastic day. And legends like you imbue it with that extra sparkle and that extra shine. Thank you, thank you, thank you for being spectacular as always, buddy. It's always a joy reading your comments. Have a fantastic week ahead, and thank you for your support and your friendship, mate. And my third white tea warlord is the brand new Maya, aka Queen of the Cats. Maya, thank you so much for your support. I'm looking forward to sharing more creepy and spooky stories. If you have any story suggestions of your own, Maya, reach out to me. You know where I am. And it's so good to have you. Thank you very, very much. Thank you for being my pal and supporting the podcast and me. Have a kick-ass week ahead of you as well. And now, I want to thank my Earl Grey enforcers and Chamomile supporters. I'm lucky to have Jessica Garcia, Michael Krupp, Seductive Smiles, Jane Gumnick, Paige Kramer, Divided by Zero, Juicebox Andy, Just Heather, Pete Raffaelli, Chad Warren, and Marquette. A special thank you to you as well. You absolute legends. Thank you so much for your support. I hope you all have a fantastic week. I hope it goes quickly, that work isn't so crazy, and that you're all safe. And I'll see you next Sunday/Monday for some more stories. And as always, till next we meet.
Night whispers secrets untold. Ghostly tales centuries old. In the shadows, mysteries unfold.
Listeners, gather brave and bold. Stories, fables, ghostly tales. In every shadow a truth unveils.
Unveil.
As the night around us prevails, every whispered secret sails.
Sails.
Around the fire, eyes wide with fear. Clear between the real and what appears. Great week!